Hey there, my Inklings, and welcome back to Catawampus Readings, the podcast where beginnings and introductions are conjured from thin air and don't always make sense. Today we're taking a look at the world building behind one of my favorite books, a recent find from the last couple years that has utterly charmed me. Daughter of Dragons by Jack Campbell is the first book in his Legacy of Dragons series, which is a sequel to his Pillars of Reality series. I didn't know that when I picked them up, and I didn't find out until after I'd already finished reading all three books. Maybe that seems like a small thing, but that's a pretty big deal. Most sequels rely on previous installments, especially in the realm of character and world development, but I didn't feel like there were pieces of information I was missing. I didn't look at the descriptions of the world or the characters and feel like I just didn't get it. That is super awesome, and a big achievement when you think about that in the context of the five books that preceded this series. For those of you who haven't heard of this masterpiece, here's the pitch from Amazon. For centuries, the great guilds conspired to keep Demeter unchanged. The Mechanics Guild kept secret the technology for steam locomotion, rifles, and Fartalkers, leaving most people to live in a world of oil lamps, crossbows, and horse cavalry, while the mages treated all others as if they were nothing. Until Master Mechanic Marie, Dragon Slayer and Pirate Queen, and Master of Mages Elaine, raised an army to free their world. Kira of Pacta Servanda, Marie and Elaine's daughter, has known since childhood that she would always live in the shadow of her heroic parents. But then, the world of Demeter learned that a new kind of ship had left the far distant world of Urth. The ship would take just 10 years to reach Demeter, but for what purpose? Kira is 16 when the ship from Urth arrives, and she discovers that her world still needs heroes. I guess I maybe should have known from this pitch that the story that came before this had already been written. That aside, I think it does a very good job of setting things up. Here's a little backstory to get you started, here's the setup for the current plot, and a promise of adventure that's vague enough that I'm desperate to know more without being so vague that I just find it frustrating. It's walking a fine line, though, and it could easily be frustrating to someone else whose standards are slightly different than mine. 5 out of 5, very well done. So, now that we've covered all that, let's get to the good stuff. There's a section at the beginning of chapter 1 that serves as a sort of prologue without actually separating itself from the rest of the chapter. This formatting stuff is really important. It makes a difference, let me tell you. Even though this is more like a sort of introduction than part of the story itself, it feels like it's part of the story because it's included with the chapter. Let me show you what I mean. Daughter of Dragons by Jack Campbell. Chapter 1. The mages of the world of Demeter sometimes see visions, glimpses of the future or of a possible future. The future rarely happens as people expect, and even those people with the firmest belief in what their future will hold can be very mistaken. Especially when that person is the daughter of the two greatest heroes of her world. Kira of Pacta Servanda was 6 years old the day she stood on a battlement in Dor Castle, staring up at a statue of her mother while surrounded by bodyguards who fenced Kira off from the nearby crowds. As the morning sun cast the shadow of her mother's statue over Kira, she felt both invisible and an object of curiosity, and had realized that she would spend the rest of her life in that shade. Kira was still 6 years old when the world of Demeter learned that a new kind of ship had left the far distant world of Urth. The ship would only take 10 years to cover the immense distances between the stars. Of all the colony worlds, the ship was coming to Demeter because of Kira's mother. When she was 10, Kira's father, the wisest of mages, discovered that she had inherited some of his abilities as well as her mother's skill with machines, something thought impossible. But that one thing that might have made her special had to be kept secret from others, a source of worry rather than pride. Kira was 16 when the ship from Earth arrived, and she discovered that her world still needed heroes. This little introduction is much like the pitch on the back of the book, only with a little more information about our main character, Kira. I'd say this is about half world building and half character development, setting us up to understand the world as well as the character that's sharing it with us. There are mages, there is politics, and there's one surly teenager that feels outclassed by her mother. If we skip forward a few pages to the middle-ish of the first chapter, you'll see that the main character is apt to reflect on the world around her quite a bit. Now, this could come across as extremely contrived, like the first-person narrator that spends two paragraphs describing his own appearance, but I find that this particular character has a lot of reasons to think about her world as an outsider might. But she's familiar enough with the world that her thoughts are informational to the reader. This is all part of her development as the main character, and it's also extremely useful in building the world around her. Let me show you what I mean. Kira leaned back in her seat, pretending to sleep as the coach and their cavalry escort headed down the road toward Pacta Servanda. Pacta Servanda. Once only an old town, now popularly known as the city the daughter had built. The field where the ship from Earth would land lay outside the city and was already surrounded by an immense crowd, kept back by large numbers of soldiers. As the coach swept through a lane kept open in the crowd, Kira huddled back in her seat, embarrassed by sharing the privilege of Lady Marie. It wasn't like she had earned such treatment. "What exactly is landing here?" she asked her mother to distract her thoughts. "Not the whole ship?" "No," Lady Marie said. "There's some big part that detaches that can land here while the rest, including the main engines, stays above the world. Your Uncle Kalu explained to you about the relative thing, right?" "Yeah," said Kira. "Relativity. Even though the ship took 10 years to get here, time passed at a different rate inside the ship because of how it was traveling, so to them it only felt like a couple months." The coach came to a halt, the cavalry riding forward to join the nearby honor guard. Kira followed her mother and father out to find Cien waiting for them. Queen Cien of Tay wore a uniform similar to that of her cavalry, sword by her side, but with a single bright emerald and a gold band on her brow instead of an armored helm. Kira stood by, feeling worried and unnecessary, while Cien greeted her old friends and allies. I'm going to stop there because I want to draw attention to how, just with this little section, you can learn so much about this world. Our main character and her parents are riding in a coach, they're being escorted by cavalry, that sets a pretty easy standard for the kind of technology we can expect. In addition, the fact that they're discussing the ship and how it's going to land tells us that that kind of thing isn't usual for their world. A bunch of people are coming to see the ship land, which is reminiscent of such events in Cape Canaveral here in the US. Spaceships are still very much a big deal. This sort of world building is what I call implied development. That is, it's not so much that the author has set out to tell us how the world works, as it is the world itself is demonstrating how it works. It's a little different from what we saw last week, with the main character thrown into a world that's unfamiliar to us, with no explanation. As we can see here, the author is making an effort to show situations we're familiar with, so we can make connections between what's going on in the book and how it works in our own lives. Getting into the car to go to a big fancy event that a bunch of people are interested in, that's a situation that most of us have experienced at some point or another. In contrast, in Dragonflight, our story opened with an oppressed and clever slave girl plotting revenge on her evil overlord and using mind magic to sense danger in the air. Almost none of that is something that we can connect with. None of that is normal stuff that we might be able to correlate with things that we do in our everyday lives. Kira is, by comparison, the most ordinary 16-year-old I have ever seen. She's irritating, she's grumpy, she's unreasonable, but she's also utterly believable. I'm going to skip forward one more time to a section on the other side of some truly marvelous character development for a little more world building, because I really want to focus in on how they're using dialogue here to fill in the information that we don't have. Jason looked over at the cavalry, standing beside their mounts in a long row, the horses shifting positions slightly and occasionally trying to nip at each other.
Those are cool. Are they real?
Nothing is real, Kira said, unable to resist the chance to lighten the mood.
What?
That's what my father says. Everything we see is an illusion created by our minds, but those cavalry are part of the illusion, yes. To her surprise, Jason laughed.
You got me. Yeah, the observer effect and all that. From what I've heard of your, mages, scientists back on Earth have speculated that their magic involves some sort of quantum-level manipulation.
Kira shrugged. My uncle mechanic Kalu figured that out 20 years ago.
He did? That's not in any of the background materials.
Oh.
Jason snorted disdainfully. I figure some person back on Earth would claim credit for the idea. Plagiarize! Let no one else's work evade your eyes, he said, singing the words. Anyway, the soldiers with their horses. Are they reenactors of some kind? Or would they actually go to war like that?
Of course they would, Kira said. What's a reenactor?
It's someone who dresses up like someone from history, Jason explained. You know, like a hobby.
Someone from history? Kira shook her head, puzzled. But that's just like someone now, except the new mechanic weapons. The uniforms and armor haven't changed. Jason looked baffled.
Huh? I mean like centuries ago.
Yeah, that's how soldiers have always looked. He got upset for no reason Kira could understand.
If you don't want to talk about it, you don't have to.
I did talk about it. What's your problem?
Everybody knows that things don't...
Jason paused, frowning.
They've always looked like that? For centuries?
That's what I said. Kira glared at him. Why is that so confusing for you? Expositional dialogue gets a lot of flack these days because it can be so badly done. But it doesn't have to be. This is a great example of the kind of dialogue that both develops the characters and also allows them to share some of their world. The author's use of the outsider in this situation to prompt explanation was very deft, and I can see myself having this exact conversation with someone who didn't understand why humans still drank water. Oh gosh, so prehistoric. The key is to let the characters be themselves, rather than being vehicles for information for the audience. When you treat characters like people instead of like devices through which the plot happens, then conversations don't sound quite so much like robots talking to each other. That's all I have for you this week. We run a little long, but I think it was worth it. The random question of the day is, if you could have magically enhanced surgery to change your appearance, such as getting whiskers or a tail or a pair of wings, etc., would you do it? And remember, this is surgery, so it can't be undone without a lot of expense and healing time. Until next time, stay awesome, my Inklings. This has been your host, Inkfire, and you have been a very patient audience. I'll see you on the other side. Thank you for listening to Catawampus Readings. This podcast is made possible by listeners like you. If you're interested in supporting Catawampus Readings and would like early access to new episodes, you can sign up to donate monthly at patreon.com/inkfire. Special thanks to our patrons, Corvus, Valkyrie, and Barry Marie.